Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB Sioux Falls Studios in the Leo P. Flynn Gallery, and it is time for the Brown Bag Book Club. Our guest this week is author Jim Reese, and you might know Jim because he's been on the program before. He joined us for The Great American Read. He is Associate Professor of English and Director of the Great Plains Writers Tour at Mount Marty College. You know him for three poetry books that he's published before to great acclaim, Ghost on Third, Really Happy, and 2005's These Trespasses. And today we're going to talk about a forthcoming book called Bone Chalk. It comes out November 2019, and it's a book of essays for the first time. So Jim Reese, thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited when you first said that there was a book of essays coming out, because I think most people around here know you as a poet, but you've written a lot of really great essays. I've heard you read them before, and now tell us a little bit about making that journey.
Yeah, it's something I've been working on for, you know, I think I started publishing essays right when I moved up to South Dakota around 2006. I started publishing a few in the South Dakota Review, and then I just slowly have been working on them, and it's something I've always wanted to do. But it was hard for me to try to figure out how do I put them all together, or what do I do with all of them? Do I have enough of them? And so slowly it came together, and you know, and it's across the board. It's a really eclectic mix of some, you know, I really like making people laugh, and then I've got all of a sudden in the middle of the book there's this huge crime essay, which, you know, I think it's 34 pages, which is dropped right in the middle of the manuscript. Which was a whole nother entire manuscript at one point, and then I condensed it down just really about how crime has affected me and all the work I was doing in the prisons in South Dakota as well. So there's all kinds of stuff from me being the college mascot for all the wrong reasons to you know, some real serious stuff. So it came together, and it's just been a lot of fun. And then the last year I just spent a lot of time working on it and trying to get it out, you know, get it ready for publication, and was fortunate enough to find a publisher right away, so.
And there are some things that I first encountered as poetry that are in this book as essays. Many of the essays are poetic, or what I would call sort of like a more poetic kind of writing style. And Ted Kooser has a blurb saying how much he loves the book. He says it's what we might think of as an evening's entertainment, and it's an enriching entertainment at that. Witty and funny, shadowed by feelings deeper and more meaningful, a kind of operetta in prose. It will stick with me for a good long while. I recommend it. Ted Kooser, of course, the 13th Poet Laureate of the United States, also from Nebraska originally. So there's an interplay between these two forms of poetry and essay.
Yeah.
Talk about that a little bit.
It's interesting that you said that. I read that quote from Ted too, because I remember in grad school I did a reading and Ted was there, and this was right when he won the Pulitzer Prize too, and then he was United States Poet Laureate, and he was always helping us out when he wasn't on the road. He would give us advice and things like that, and I remember he walked up to me after the reading and he said, "Jim, that poem that you just read that you finished with is an entire Willa Cather book." And I didn't know what to think about that at first. I was like, okay. But he was right. The poem was, you know, just condensed down, but it was this huge story. And then I thought about that for a while and then just said, okay, I'm going to write this essay. And that was the encouragement I needed. And he was really instrumental in encouraging that. And some other people, some writers I went to school with, Daryl Farmer, and some other people right away. Once I wrote a couple essays, and some other editors, they encouraged me to keep doing that. And at the same time, too, you know, our first daughter was just born, so you have life and all those things going on at the same time, too. So it was just one of those things I kept doing and working on and putting it together.
So we're going to ask you to read from this book in a minute, and we're going to start with the Mother-in-Law Archives. But before you read that, talk a little bit about writing about people that you know, and she's aware that you often write about her, so she sort of, you know, throws things in like, well, you can't write about this until you do. You know, she's got a little bit of control in here. But there are other people throughout this book as a city kid coming into this sort of rural environment, marrying into this family, You're always this outsider looking in, fitting in, not fitting in, trying to figure out about, you know, themes of masculinity, themes of living in rural America in the heartland. There's a lot going on there. But address, if you will, this, yeah, this notion of a writer observing the people that you are bumping up against on a daily basis, mm-hmm, and then putting pen to paper, telling part of their stories.
I like that you said all that stuff, because that's what I was trying to do. And I think as it's just curiosity and always, I don't know, maybe it's a only child syndrome kind of thing. You know, I'm always asking why and putting myself in situations just to experience them. I think, you know, why not? And I was very interested in this for a very long time. You know, I remember going to college and, you know, I was the college mascot. I was gone then. I didn't come back to Omaha for about 3 months, I think, 2 or 3 months right away. And I remember, you know, so I'm in the small town for, immersed in the small town for 2 or 3 months. And then I go back home to Omaha and I go to my local, which would be my local gas station, which was close to my neighborhood, which is, I don't know, you know, hundreds and hundreds of acres or what, thousands. No, but it was our gas station that you went to. And I went to, I was walking in the door and I held the door open for somebody and I said, hey, how's it going? And the guy looked at me and he goes, what the hell's your problem? And I thought, oh, welcome home, you know? And so that was really troubling to me, like, what is going on here? Like this, you know, where am I at in this world? What am I doing? Who do I want to be? You know, all that came to head one day. And so I started asking a lot of questions and really looking at people and trying to discover who I wanted to be and what I wanted to be. And so, yeah, I just love immersing myself in these stories and learning about people, yeah, and trying to do my best to tell their stories the best I can. And that's by just investigating and doing a lot of work and listening, I hope, yeah, you know, the right way.
Read a little bit of the Mother-in-Law Archives for us, if you would, please. From this manuscript, it's not a book yet. November we get to see it, but we have the manuscript in front of us, which is a delight for me to sort of be one of the first readers, or one of the early readers.
All right. This is just set up at the beginning. It's year one, pre-engagement, and then the second section is just married. My mother-in-law, the keeper of all things whole and necessary, puts leftover food in little plastic baby food containers and yogurt cups she has saved, will leave half a chicken wing for someone else to eat, wraps up and refrigerates one slice of bacon, puts lemon juice on half an apple so it won't turn brown, has a drawer full of mustard, barbecue, and soy sauce packages from takeout restaurants from out of town. She cuts coupons, cuts up and collects newspaper articles if she knows someone in the article or knows someone who knows the person in the article. Gives me play-by-plays of garage sales and auctions. Saves fresh scraps for stray cats and bones for the dogs. Saves for Jesus and saves for you. Picks green tomatoes before the first winter freeze, wraps them in tissue paper, serves them for Thanksgiving dinner. Balances soap dispensers upside down like others do with ketchup bottles and eventually combines them in one. She has a room full of old jeans in case her husband's overalls need patching or her son-in-law's crotch blows out. She makes pie crust from lard, has full canning jars from the 80s, has unidentifiable things in her deep freeze. Once, I saw her pull a tarp for a pickup bed out from underneath her dresser. I've been holding on to this, I don't know how long. If you need something, a blowtorch, nunchucks, twist ties, marbles, propane, a chandelier, suspenders, a curtain rod, spare tire, a putter, a basin wrench, bell bottoms, a bowling ball, anything, she's your woman. Year 6.5. My mother-in-law sends me detailed reports about plantar fasciitis, the weather, a neighbor, and family feuds. Although I only live about a mile from her and we see each other frequently, she still sends me group emails. I had a cortisone shot in my heel last Friday. The heel pain is gone. Just hope it doesn't come back. I went to the JCPenney watch repair department today. They didn't have links to my watch, but the clerk will order some and send them to me. I can fix it. I'm not paying someone to do it. It was a perfect day today, but ice and snow is coming tomorrow. And once I emailed her and asked her what it was like to be married to a farmer all these years. I expected one of her long emails, something I could put in my book about the Midwest so I'd get a better understanding of things. A perspective from a woman who was born during the Great Depression, a generation that struggled and sacrificed to make ends meet. She never responded. Year 9. My father-in-law and I are eating dinner, Swedish meatballs, potatoes, corn, and bread. You won't believe this, my mother-in-law says, but I found a container of cherries in the deep freeze that I froze in 1978. They still look good, so I made a pie out of them. We've been eating it and haven't gotten sick yet, my father-in-law says. That's the gospel truth. There wasn't a lot of freezer burn on them, I had to ask. Some, but not that much. And she shows me the container the cherries were in. She dates and labels everything in the deep freeze. The masking tape is yellowed, the writing worn and barely readable. And you cannot write about this or tell anyone who I am until you try a piece for yourself. That's the deal. Bring it on, I say. And she reaches into the freezer. Because she was already frozen the pie, she doesn't want the leftovers to go to waste. She thaws two pieces in the microwave. My father-in-law digs into his piece. Are you sure it didn't say 1998, I ask? She smiles as I dig in too.
Author Jim Reese reading a little bit from the book Bone Chalk. That essay is called The Mother-in-Law Archives. Just a snippet there of that. I'd love to listen to you read about her.
Oh, she's a great person.
And this is the thing, I think, that I'm getting at with the question I asked before mm-hmm. you read this, is that we all recognize her in some way through the people that we know, even if it's not an exact copy of someone in our life. Somebody has someone who's, because we're from the same place.
Yeah.
Why do you think it's important to talk about being specific about the details of even the faded masking tape that somehow becomes universal because all of us have had somebody pull something out of the freezer in this part of the country. And, you know, we look at the labeling and we kind of we question whether or not we should eat it.
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, just for me to go back to that question, it was interesting to me because I felt like I was coming from, I did, you know, essentially come from two different worlds a little bit, or two different places. You know, I was an urban city kid, you know, that I wasn't relied on to, you know, if the animals got out or something happened, I wasn't relied on for a lot of things. I mean, the work I did, you know, I had to vacuum the carpet or dust the furniture, or, you know, I mean, maybe, you know, if we couldn't fix it at home, or if I couldn't fix it, or my dad couldn't fix it, you know, we called the repairman. You know, so it's different when you move to the country and move to a more rural setting. And I, you know, my family now, there a lot of them are farmers, and you know they work hard, and so that was a cool thing to see that and learn all that, continue to learn it. So I still don't know if I'm answering your question exactly, but. It was neat to also just celebrate where I'm from. I think, you know, when you're younger, you always have this idea of the grass is greener, you got to go somewhere else to, you know, to a bigger place. I think somebody on your show last week, some guys were talking about that. You know, you got to go to this bigger place and experience some stuff. Then you can, you know, go back to where you're from or whatever. But, you know, there's just so many great things going on right where we are. You know, and the more I get a chance to go around and present at different places around the country, I think I appreciate where I'm from even more.
Yeah.
You know,
sending that literature out to those places too to see kind of who we are. So
yeah,
we need to take a break. We'll come back with more with author Jim Reese after the break. Stay with us on listener supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Leo P. Flynn Gallery in the Sioux Falls studio. And my guest for today's Brown Bag Book Club is the author Jim Reese. He has a forthcoming book in November 2019, but you can pre-order it now on Amazon, and it is called Bone Chalk. And this is a book of essays. And here's another letter of support, really, from authors. We talked about Ted Kooser in the last segment, but Craig Johnson, who is a well-known crime novelist and is also coming to South Dakota Festival of Books in 2019, talks about a startling honesty that slams you against the wall by the throat and holds you there until you see the truth, a unique perspective into the world of true crime from a gifted writer. So now we're going to talk a little bit about crime and how it has really influenced your life, changed your life in ways that I didn't know until I read this manuscript for Bone Chalk, Jim, because you and I have talked before about your work teaching creative writing to prisoners in the federal prison system, the work you've done giving back. I did not know about the crime in your community, in your neighborhood growing up, about the death of your friend in high school. Where do you want to start talking about let's talk about the man in Nebraska who abducts children and the fear that you kind of had as a little kid growing up of being that face on the milk carton.
Yeah, that's where the manuscript starts, you know. When I was proposing this book, one of the publishers I was very interested in it said, we might ask you for some more stuff. So I had a whole nother book, a rough draft of a book I was working on, which is the title of this essay, which was 12 Years in Prisons and What Criminals Teach Me. So I ended up taking that manuscript, I think it might have been, 150 pages, and just condensing it down to what's in the book now, which is 34 pages, and changed it. You know, I kept looking for an answer. How are we going to solve problems for criminal justice? And it was very academic. And some of the editors and writers I was working with, specifically Kent Meyer, he's a great friend of mine and a great writer and a very, very good editor as well. And he said, you know, you've got a great academic manuscript here, a great academic essay, but now why don't you change gears and really talk about how crime has affected you? Mm-hmm. And so that's what I did with this essay. And just thought about that and then put that in a chronological order all the way up to now. You know, I just got done teaching a program for 2 years at the state prisons here in South Dakota at the women's prison and the men's prison. A writing program that we had there was about 2.5 years. But all this time I've also been teaching at the federal prison in Yankton. And part of that program too, we did a lot of training for 4 years. We went to San Quentin back and forth to do some training and watch their arts programs. And so I started putting all that together and then really started at the beginning. So where did this start? What was going on in my life? And tried to put it in somewhat of a in order from the beginning. So if I start in Nebraska, it was 1984, serial killer, the Nebraska boy snatcher, John Jubert, was arrested. This is where I come from, urban middle America with apartment buildings and rows of split-level houses, manicured lawns and shopping malls. Never talk to strangers were four words constantly drilled into me and my friends because a lot of us were latchkey kids. We like to believe the neighbors looked out for us. When the serial killer John Jubert volunteered as a Boy Scout troop leader to lure and torture young boys, eventually kidnapping and killing two kids in the same part of Omaha where I lived, he became the nightmare, proof of the validity of those four words. None of us will ever forget the police crime sketch on milk cartons and plastered to street poles, this gruesome profile of a man with his mirrored sunglasses and hoodie pulled tight around his head. It was my neighborhood he did this in, and we wanted it back. To sleep most nights, I curled in a fetal position and stared at my bedroom window shades. It didn't matter what our parents said to console us. They were full of anger that this could happen in the Midwest, in the heartland. So we all reinvented worrying. Never again would talk to strangers, because every one of them was him. We looked over our shoulders and learned to run the second an unfamiliar car stopped and someone inside asked for direction. It was the paranoia of the 80s in Omaha. And around the same time, I fell at the bus stop and stabbed an icicle into my knee. The school bus driver hollered, "Either board or I'm leaving." He left, and blood oozed as I limped back to the strip mall next to Country Club Village, the apartments where we lived. A guy came out of the office to help, tried to reach my folks at work without luck, and then took me to school. Mr. Shiver practically yanked my arm out of the socket for catching a ride from a complete stranger, someone he didn't even know. That's when I knew my world had changed. These were the war zones of my home, which made us aware of our surroundings. After peace and love had fallen on the cusp of cocaine and everyone began living faster and meaner, this was when you, John, were living with your nightmares, perhaps calculating rapes, cuttings, and killings. Ashes, ashes, John. No, no, no. That's where the essay starts. And then I, you know, and that was real, you know, that was our reality. And then high school started, and this is 1990, the murder of Christina O'Day. Christina had been babysitting overnight. Chris Garza and another perpetrator cut the phone line, broke in a basement window, tied her up, slit her wrists, took turns raping her, and then left her to die. For a few days after it happened, the police couldn't find him. His head shot on rerun on the news, the high school, the whole city of Omaha in an uproar. It was surreal, but it was our reality. In our high school hallways, I remember some of the friends Chris used to hang with before he dropped out, saying they knew where he was hiding. The gossip, the uneducated comments from some of those people in a class of over 450 was beyond disturbing and immature. The child Christina was babysitting is still alive. And the whole episode was replayed in the news 26 years later. Garza had been resentenced for the 1990 murder of Christina O'Day. He was given 96 to 110 years in prison. The judge, factoring in good time law and time already served, Garza would be eligible for parole in about 23 years. And he is one of two men who beat, raped, and murdered Christina O'Day as she was babysitting. And at the age of 8, Beth Ann listened as the brutal crime unfolded. This is all from WWT 6 News. Joe Chioda wrote this in the paper, and it said, 26 years after the murder, a Supreme Court decision means one of O'Day's killers, then 16-year-old Christopher Garza, is in line for resentencing. That based on a new research showing at the age of 6, a portion of the juvenile's brain is not fully developed. WWT 6 News spoke exclusively with Christina's mother, Sheila O'Day, following the sentencing. It's been hard to come to terms over the years, the anger, frustration, sorrow, but it's time to move on. I feel justice has been served. I wish I knew her. It's like your child left 26 years ago and you never saw them again. I believe she's at peace, but I still don't know her. I wish I could. I wish I could. And Beth Ann, now 34, returned from Georgia to attend the sentencing. She said it's a second chance at justice for O'Day. So when I think of this murder from my adolescence and of the safe split-level suburbia I came from, the fear is still ingrained in me. But what I know, after spending the last 12 years teaching in prisons, is that most prisoners aren't heinous animals. They aren't wicked criminals. And just to close this section of the essay off, it says, in an article, The Effects of Prison Education Programs on Recidivism, John Esperin notes, undoubtedly some individuals, murderers, rapists, child molesters, are either unwilling or unable to live and work as honest, hardworking brokers within the framework of society. These dangerous antisocial cases need to be kept in confinement permanently for the safety of the community. And obviously, I would agree with that. So I go back and look at this story from high school and talk about it. Christina was a friend of mine, and it really had a big impact on all of us, and it changed everything.
And there's this moment where you're invited as a teacher, as a professor with credentials, as an author, you can teach people how to write, and you're invited to come and teach some of these people who have committed crimes, maybe not murderers or rapists, but people in this federal prison system. You start on this path of working with criminals, working with prisons, working with the people who are going to be released, of which there are thousands every year who are released into communities across America. Do you have an awareness at that point that crime has touched your life in this way that's personal? I mean, not as much as some people, of course, but more than others. Do you know, are you looking for some? I mean, you knew the high school girl who died. Are you looking for something at this point to try to figure out who these people are?
I write about that at that point, you know, because it's in a chronological order. Right after that happened, then we both, my friend and I, went to the same college together, and we both became criminal justice majors. This is 1991. You know, Silence of the Lambs just came out, too. So we're fascinated by this idea. Why do criminals do what they do? At least I was. And that major lasted for a year, and I switched my major multiple times. And in a roundabout way, in a big circle, here I am working in the criminal justice field, and also I'm a college professor teaching writing. And so it is something that always fascinated me because I wanted to know why did this happen, why did it happen? And I don't know if I'll ever have an answer for that specific crime. But then once I started working in prisons too, it took about 5 or 6 years for me to realize, hey, what are you doing here? You know, like, it was cool the first couple of years to say, oh, I'm going to San Quentin. You know, I'm a writer, I can say, I thought that was cool to tell people. I get to go to this, you know, place you see on TV and at this sensationalized place. And then, it was just an ego, you know, that's what it was. And then I started thinking, what are you really doing, Jim? Why is this interesting to you? Set your ego aside. What's your purpose here? And then about 5 or 6 years into it, I realized, you know, wow, I can really, really help some people. I was always trying to help them, but it took a big shift. And, you know, I got older and I was a father, I was more mature. And I was thinking, you know, you can really make a difference in people's lives. And then, so do it. And I started doing that. And it's my passion. And it's what gets me up in the morning. You know, I think it's important. I think one of the times I was at San Quentin, too, I was reading, they have their own newspaper. It's 432 acres. It's this huge place. It said you can lock a person up and put them in jail, and that's all fine and good, and you can teach them a trade. But what you also have to do is you have to help that person come to terms with the emotional instabilities that brought them to prison in the first place. Because if you don't, then you're just going to send a pissed off person right back into society. Hmm. So I think it's our obligation as a society. My job as a teacher, especially since I'm teaching in a prison, to try to help men and women come to terms with why they're there, and then hopefully they leave and never come back and are productive members of society.
We're talking this hour with author Jim Reese. His forthcoming book is called Bone Chalk. It's released in November of 2019, but you can pre-order it now. We'll take a break and have more with Jim Reese in just a moment on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're broadcasting live today from the Leo P. Flynn Gallery in SDPB's Sioux Falls studio. My guest is author Jim Reese. He has three books of poetry, another book of poetry coming out as well soon. But this book we're talking about today is called Bone Chalk, and it's a book of essays and nonfiction from the author. That's released November 2019. And Jim, we're going to ask you to, we're going to press upon you to read a little bit more, because this is one of my favorite essays. And I think a lot of people really connect with this one because it is about your time as a college mascot. and listeners, we're going to get a little playfully raunchy here. So,
all right.
So prepare yourself, because this is Willie the Wildcat.
All right. I'll jump right in. This is my life as Willie the Wildcat. I became Wayne State's mascot for all of the wrong reasons. School spirit was not one of them. Teamwork, nope. I was silly, Willie the Wildcat. I was the guy behind the mask, inside an overstuffed thermal insulated sauna of a costume. I had pecs for the first time in my life. I was larger than life, and people loved me. The seamstress who designed the costume went with a gender-neutral character, all smiles and whiskers, for the kids. Underneath the straps, pads, and mask, inside the fur, it was me, all 120 pounds. In their own serene way, people always asked, what does one have to do to become a mascot? Or, more bluntly, they'd fire, what? What were you thinking? You know, I still don't mind the questions. Everyone at some time wouldn't mind jumping inside outside skin. And let's be honest, since I was a kid, I always wanted to have someone else's body. Not that mine was horrible, but I was weak and skinny. I never really had muscle. I daydreamed about other people's figures for about 20 years, until all of those people I secretly admired started to balloon in weight, lose their hair, and become, oddly, disproportioned. As the mascot, I was invited to the parties after the game. I was on the prowl. I always went in costume, of course. I was a riot. I was the life of the party. I could seriously dance my tail off. You know, if you look up the word mascot in the dictionary, it says, the one believed to bring good luck. And I was determined to explore luck's facets to the extreme. Picture a small northeast Nebraska town with a population of 8,000. Imagine Main Street running north and south from one end of town to the other. Cobblestone and brick side streets still intact. This is Wayne, America, home of chicken days. This little island in northeast Nebraska would become another ghost town if it wasn't for the college and this yearly festival. Nevertheless, a lot of the locals spent the majority of their time complaining about the higher institution and the corruption it brought to the community. In essence, Wayne State was and still is a suitcase college. Often students go back home to family farm on the weekends to help out, or they make the two-hour trip south to Omaha to the big city. Thursday was and still is party night, so by the time Saturday's games roll around, students are gone. When I was the mascot, the football team didn't have a good year. The basketball team wasn't much better. I spent Saturdays in sparsely populated stadiums and gymnasiums, sometimes sleeping inside my costume. Our crew was a group of 18, 19, and 20-year-olds whose emotional intelligence wasn't fully developed. We were a tight-knit, an eclectic group of characters with an odd sense of school spirit. The mascot job was serious business. I was to represent my college on and off campus. More than once, I jogged the length of Wayne, America and back, up and down Main Street from the campus to the outer city limits for parades and festivities. My motto should have been, have costume, will run. The town itself had lost its school spirit. As much as the locals complained about the college, they still rallied around Wayne State when they were winning. Who else do I have to root for around here? Was something I heard with a sad kind of chuckle on a few occasions. They were fair-weather fans, which was quite evident. And because of the town's size and the narrow-minded mentality of some, being the town pick-me-up could be difficult. I didn't quite understand the dynamics of small-town America, but I was learning quickly. How did I get the gig? The school was hard up early, and by word of mouth, I heard from another male cheerleader in my dorm that the position was open. And for some reason, this new proposition intrigued me. I saw myself as a star on and off the field. Wherever I went, people would be talking about me. It was an early disillusionment, an eagerness that seemed to come so naturally for me. Upon arriving at the college, I remember my father saying, I'll guarantee you'll find something to get involved with here. Sky's the limit, kid. And deep down inside, I did want to please my parents. I wanted to be more than just a mediocre kid who could kind of play the guitar. I wasn't a prodigy. I wasn't an athlete. I could ollie pretty high on a skateboard, but couldn't ride a half pipe. I was writing these incredibly bad poems that I thought would stand the test of time. I wasn't quite pushing myself to my full potential. I had an excessive knowledge of music, had long, wavy, pretty hair. I was good at posing, but I really wanted and needed to do something with some conviction. I wanted to stand out. Besides trying to please my parents, I actually thought the costume might benefit me in more than one way. I actually thought it might help me find a date, or perhaps even a girlfriend with whom I could share my poetry. I met the 7-member cheer squad in a fluorescent lit practice area inside the field house. All the cheerleaders seemed alert and giddy. I felt like I was in a room full of people high-strung on Mountain Dew. I was nervous. I figured if I blew mascot tryouts, that would be the end of amounting to anything. In my mind, I had pictured a long line of us ready to try out. At least 10 people, right? I was unaware of the school's athletic record, though. It was only me and a guy from Wyoming who already had previous experience. We both listened and waited to try out while Carrie, the cheer squad captain, laid out the ground rules. Carrie was a 5th-year senior squad leader. I'd seen her parading around campus in her cheerleading outfit before. It was something I'd grown accustomed to in high school, but here, it seemed a bit odd. She always wore the college's home colors, a black skirt pulled up a little too high. Her black and gold spandex top was fitting and snug. Being Willie is a privileged position here at Wayne State. Go Wildcats! Not only are you representing all of us as a team, you're representing Wayne State. Woo! It was virtually impossible for Carrie to say Wayne State without a weeping cheer. There will be times when you're expected to go above and beyond your call of duty. Every parade in town, the school's alumni picnics, the town hall Halloween trick for tots, you are expected to be present at all of these special events. It's tradition, and this year, if we play our cards right, Wayne State has promised to reimburse us. They have promised to pay for all of our textbooks for the fall and spring semesters. Woohoo! I heard Wyoming mumble, "Screw this place. Picnics? Trick for tots?" "Yeah," I tissed under my breath. "Willie the friggin' Wildcat," Wyoming said. "Man, I'm a Newcastle doggie. I don't need this." To be honest, I was relieved. I didn't want to face the fact that I might be a failure at mascot tryouts. Athletically, this was my last straw. When I found out he'd been a mascot before, I was truly intimidated. But now, I knew I had him beat. I knew that Wyoming didn't have the attitude and spunk necessary to carry out such expectations. I made eye contact with Carrie, smiled and nodded every time she barked out orders. "Go Cats!" I hollered. "Oh, I'm sorry," Carrie said sadly. "Willie can't talk." We took turns trying out. I had to stand out in the hallway while Mr. Doggy, the motherless calf that he was, strutted his stuff. When it was my turn, I was instructed to put Willie's mask on and excite the audience for 3 minutes. The mask was large in circumference and size, barely resting on my puny shoulders. It smelled awfully foul. My eyes watered the first time I put it on. "The key," Carrie said, "is to keep Willie's head from falling off during stunts and routines. Now let's see you shake that thing." Carrie hollered as the music pumped through a large boombox. "Y'all ready for this?" I peered through the enormous grin that was Willie's mouth. Through the dark mesh, I could barely make out figures and shapes. The bass of the stereo was kicking and I began to pop a few locks. My arms and body took on a life of their own. I was gyrating to the music and clawing at the air. I began to juke and jive and a slow, predatory, animalistic strutter step followed. What would Willie do? I thought. I compensated for my lack of a tail and mimed imaginary actions, got on all fours, arched my back, and frolicked with positions that were downright dirty. Every once in a while, as I tried to catch my breath in this new mask and body of mine, I peered over my shoulder at the crowd of cheerleaders, egging them on for something more than just a tailspin. If I could have, I would have licked my whiskers and lips, would have roared, but that was against the rules. I'm not sure why simulating an animal brings out sexualized behaviors in others, in me, and I didn't care. I mean, really, aren't we all animals with a few quirks and characteristics that tell us apart from the herd? After the first minute, I knew I had them. I might as well have been calling up the spirits. I was back in the animal kingdom. When the music finished, I was already soaked inside the mask. I had managed to work up an incredible sweat and thirst for more. I knew appetite was the road to life and culture. A few of the male cheerleaders came over and sized me up. Carrie instructed Gus, one of the male co-leaders, to toss me in the air. I put my right foot in his hands, grabbed hold of my wildcat ears, and was airborne. He and another cheerleader caught me, and for a second cradled me like a newborn child. Hell, he can't weigh more than a 115 sopping wet, Gus said. Good, good, Carrie squealed. Bring the other guy in before we make our final decision. We have a few questions for you.
I'm trying not to laugh into my microphone.
I'm trying not to laugh.
You cut out some dirty parts, so.
Yeah, there's a lot I cut out. I'm trying to be careful here.
You have to read the full essay for the in Bone Chalk for the full experience of being a college mascot.
Yeah, there is a big climactic ending at that essay too.
There's mistaken identity. There's alcohol. There's.
You know, we traveled with a costume, and that was a mistake. We went to our rival school, and some things happened. So yeah, it was a fun essay to read and learn. You know, it's just interesting when you put on a costume and then see how people react to you.
Is that what being a writer is in some ways? Let's get back to this notion of this sort of being on the outside looking in, being an outsider, coming, you know, being a fish out of water, and in this case, really fully donning something that covers you and conceals you and allows you to be someone, which is what writing is.
You've said outsiders a few times during this interview, and that's one of our favorite books. You know, when we talk, I think back to some other interviews that we've done, and that was one of the titles somebody suggested for this book too, because I am an outsider. I always feel like in these essays, I'm kind of, you know, of two minds a lot in so many of them. You know, I am an outsider and I'm trying to learn about these new places. That's really intriguing to me. Like, I'm a big believer in gonzo journalism. I was a huge Hunter S. Thompson fan. I bought into the myth, you know, and you know, I was a huge fan until he killed himself, and not so much anymore. But Charles Bowden was another writer that really inspired me. I had the chance to meet him, and he's done just some tremendous work in writing. And so I got a chance to meet him in Deadwood, you know, when I first moved up to South Dakota, and we became friends. And he taught me a lot about how to interview people, how to listen to people, how to let them run the recorder, and just just be there. And people really want to tell their story. And I think we all do, don't we? I mean, I think that's, at the end of the day, I mean, really, what's important to you? Yeah.
And that takes us back to the work that you do at Montmartre College with the Great Plains Writing Festival, with your work in prisons, is opening that door for other people through the example of telling your own story and how that's done and the craft of it, but also through encouraging other people to pick up a pen and paper and start writing their way through some emotional, you know, gunk, how do you sort of help people with that emotional part of it? Because you've had to deal with this very specifically. College kids write their papers to you and tell the page about horrific things that have happened in their lives. Certainly you've seen that. In the prisons, you've processed your own thing. What's your advice or recommendation? How do you walk people through that emotional task of telling the truth?
Yeah, I have a lot of really good prompts to get them started. I think the best thing as a teacher is you just have to create an environment where somebody feels safe to tell their story. Because it doesn't matter if I'm in a prison or in a college classroom at Mount Marty, there's no socioeconomic boundaries of what happens and where it happens, and if crime is there or bad things are happening, and people need oftentimes to tell their story to make some sense of it. You know, that's why I in that essay, in the crime essay, I'm talking about Christina's murder, because I for a long time I tried to make sense of it, or anything. You know, it could be, you know, trying to understand these important people in my life and just being there and enjoying life and. So I think once you establish that environment, people are eager to tell their stories. There's a great book called Writing Poetry to Save Your Life by Maria Mazziotti Gillen. I would highly recommend that for everybody. There's over, I'm sure, 1,000 prompts in the back of that book that will help you get started. And I've just written down things that have worked. I remember being in Pittsburgh. I was doing a reading at Chatham University, and they've got this great program for the prison there, or the jail and prison, Allegheny County Jail. We went there, and but they also do some stuff around town. And I asked one of the teachers there, I said, I said, I'm going to be teaching at the women's prison in South Dakota. What's something, do I need to know something different, or do I just approach it the same way? And she said, you know, the first thing you do when you go in there, I'm going to tell you what to ask them. She said, here's the question. She said, ask them to finish this. No one ever asked me. And then let them write. And I think if you do that with everybody, it helps.
What has no one ever asked you that you actually want to be asked?
Oh, I don't know. Let me think about it. And then I'll come back. I'll come back in a couple of months so we can talk about it. That's a great question. I think that's, you know, really when you find your good friends and find, you know, your husbands and wives and things like that, it's those people that are, you know, listen.
Right.
And I hope by telling stories and writing these things, and this is just the beginning, you know? I mean, I love this genre. I love the work I'm doing with police right now, you know, to understand the front end of crime, the stories I'm already working on right now that nobody knows about. I've spent about 120 hours with the police in my town trying to understand crime from the front end before I write more about it.
Yeah.
And it's just interesting when people, I mean, there's just so many interesting things going on in our world, and why not try to learn as much as you can about all of them?
And so much in this book, Bone Chuck, I can't wait to see the hardcover when it comes out in November. You can pre-order it now on Amazon. Jim Reese will be at the South Dakota Festival of Books this fall in Deadwood, and hopefully we'll see you there. And please come back when the book is released, because we really just scratched the surface today.
I would love to. Thanks so much for having me.